I'd like to talk this evening a little bit about the idea of going forth. Of course, I have Gali's ordination on Sunday, and this is one of the marks, one of the great moments in someone's life, the spiritual development. The notion of ordination or going forth is like a notion of a threshold, a line to cross over, a boundary. And one which has always been of great significance within Buddhist tradition. Sometimes in some traditions or some religions pride themselves on having no such distinctions. Everyone's the same, at least in theory. Whereas in Buddhism we have this conventional divide, the ordained Sangha and the lay community. And staying here as anagarikas or lay residents and so on, then in a sense this is a slightly in-between state, so we kind of prolong this in-between state a little bit. About that stepping over the line from anagarika to samanera or samaneri is much more definitive. You're in there, you're a member of the Sangha, you have the duties and responsibilities which are expected of someone who's gone forth. The duties to be keeping the Vinaya, to be respecting the Vinaya, to be respecting the other Sangha members, doing duties for the teacher or duties for the senior members of the Sangha, duties and so on in the monastery, keeping the place clean, all of those kinds of things. And these are all part of the things that are found in the Vinaya and part of the training. So this is a very holistic training, it's very integrated training. And it's interesting for me because I spend quite some time these days teaching lay people, and I see how they are constantly struggling to find this kind of integration in their Dhamma practice, and how hard it is to they can find a Dhamma teaching these days. In a country like Australia, it's quite easy to find good Dhamma teaching and meditation teaching. There's many groups and sitting groups and everything, and they can go to temples and centres, incredible resources online and everything. So they can easily find plenty of teachings and meditation and everything. But the thing which is very difficult is then how that integrates and relates to everything else in their life. And as for us as monastics, it's like the foundational decision that we make is that we're going to not sort of take our existing life as it is, as it was, and see how we can fit Dhamma in there as best we can. But we're going to leave our pre-existing life behind and undertake a new way of living, which has the Dhamma and the Vinaya as its basis. And so we build it like that from the ground up, quite literally. And as you know, even literally, the buildings are built like that. They're built on a basis of Dhamma and Vinaya. We build the monastery on donations. We maintain it and build it and everything on volunteer labour as much as we can. We build up our bodies out of donated food. We protect ourselves in the cold weather using robes and cloth that's been donated. Everything in our life, everything that we surround ourselves, is something that's been given freely for the use of the Sangha. And generally speaking, for someone who's gone forth, they should only have a few personal possessions. So typically just your bowl, your robes, and a few little personal items like that that you might have. Everything else which you use doesn't belong to you personally, but it belongs to the Sangha. It belongs to the community. So the kutis we stay in do not belong to us. We just stay there for a while. With the permission of the Sangha, the books and resources in the library, they don't belong to us. All of these things are things which are shared in the community, and we're just one of the people who make use of those facilities for a period of time. And so this very much runs counter to our modern Western tendency, and I think it probably is originally a Western tendency, although it's become globalized like so many other tendencies, but the tendency towards individualism, to dressing differently and having your own individual things. So everyone has their own individual car, everyone has their own individual computer, mobile phone, this and that, that they define and create their sense of identity with. You know, someone has their own style, personal style, their own things they like to cook, their own books they like to read, their own kind of exercise that they like to do. So all these kind of things, they all have they're all creating a kind of identity. So when we join the Sangha, as much as possible, we're leaving those things behind. And in letting go of that kind of personal, those personal constructed kind of identity, we are in a sense placing ourselves under or subsuming ourselves within a much bigger, a much more noble archetype or way of being. In that way of being of the samana. And so the way of being of a samana has a timeless quality to it. It's something which is not not easy to pin down, because there can be great samanas who are in different religious paths. They don't have to be Buddhists. There may be great samanas who are very different in terms of their personality, in terms of what they do, and so on and so forth, and yet there is still this quality to them which we can identify, we can feel has this quality of a samana or an ascetic or a renunciate. And so it's got something to do with simplicity, something to do with contentment, something to do with renunciation, something to do with gentleness and kindness. So a samana might be, find that a samana might be strict or stern in certain cases if they need be, but only if that was necessary for people's benefit. Most of the time we'd expect them to be very gentle and have a lot of compassion. And there's a thing, there's a quality also of evenness that if they're one of the samana qualities, that is not operating out of personal favoritism and biases, and trying to treat all people equally, and respecting the dignity and of each person, and that's part of the quality of not harming, So trying to live life in a way that doesn't bring any harm in any way. So this, of course, is a constant inquiry. One of the realizations of the Bodhisattva, according to the traditional myths about the Siddhartha's early life, when he watched the plow turning up the worms and so on, and then the birds coming down and eating the worms that had been turned up, and then just realizing that even that most innocuous activity on the field for growing rice, that basic human technology of agriculture, which is the foundation for all human civilization, that is itself essentially bound up with pain, with harm, with destruction of life. So to some extent our lives must, whether consciously or unconsciously, intentionally or unintentionally, bring harm in some way. But the samana is always trying to be sensitive to this and always trying to reduce it and eliminate it whenever possible, and always trying to bring as much benefit to outweigh any harm that they might do, even unintentionally. So when you discard your kind of personal sense of identity in terms of, you know, wearing the badges of me, I wear these kinds of clothes and so on, and you take up the ochre robe, then in a way you become quite a blank field for the projection of other people's expectations. And I can just think, you know, a few examples of that. When just one time Ajahn Khemananda told me a story, and I can't remember if this happened to him or someone else. And they were in a walking along in an airport as a monk, and they're just walking along, and then someone comes up to them and says, homage or something like that, oh great. Great Kung Fu master. That's one response he got. And then another one, again Ajahn Khemah told me this story, but I can't remember if it was from him or of him or about another one, but he was on a plane and sitting there on the plane, and the air hostess comes up. Obviously this wasn't on Thai Airways, but air hostess comes up and says, and there'll be no singing and dancing in the aisles from you, okay? Different projections that people put on you. And one time it happened to me. I was standing at the traffic light. I was going to give a talk in Chatswood, and I was just standing at the pedestrian crossing, and a couple of people and these little kids came up and talking and stuff, and then one of these kids, only like 10 or 12 or something, and he's saying, oh yeah, I'm a monk, I'm cool, and I've got power or something like that. And then he just walked straight across the street in front of all the traffic because he was a monk and had all the power to stop all the cars. And another time, so we went past some kids in the near the hall in Woolwich, and one of them says, oh, you're a monk, you like look out, be nice to people and look after the environment and stuff, right? And I say, yeah, something like that. He says, oh, that's cool, yeah. So all of these kinds of things that people will, from an external point of view, will project on you. And most of them are pretty okay, you know, as Buddhist monastics, we don't have, a lot of, I certainly haven't found a lot of negative projections that people tend to place on you. Maybe misunderstanding or confusion or something like that, but most people seem to be pretty okay with the idea. And one of the nice things about that is that and I think why it's really important to have Buddhist monastics around in these day and ages is to provide a counterpoint or a point of stillness. And, you know, we hardly even need to comment on how, you know, frenetic and frenzied and disturbed our world seems to be, and how we try to create a place of stillness. And so this is one of the reasons why, as a monastic, that we can enjoy the luxury of, you know, having people offer food and having people offer a beautiful place to live in like this, and that they will have such faith in that, is because it means so much to them to know that there are people who will just want to step aside and just very gently, very simply live a life of contentment and peace. And most people, you know, I mean, you always get some kind of silliness in Buddhist communities, and some people kind of go around thinking, oh, if you're ordained, you know, you must have all psychic powers and blah 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 or whatever, and sometimes people will be hypercritical or gossip or something like that. But I think that's a minority, and in the generally speaking, I think most people in the Buddhist community are well aware that monastics are just people, and with human foibles and capacities and all of these things, and that they, you know, don't expect us to be enlightened, they don't expect us to be necessarily the wisest people or the best or whatever, but they do expect us to have a sincerity, to have a care with keeping the rules and so on, which are important, and to respecting the people's customs and traditions, which are important to them, even if they may not be important to us. And since an act of gesture of respect is to acknowledge that. And I think that most people really appreciate what, you know, the fact that we can take our time to do things, and unlike a lot of monastic traditions which you see in Australia these days, with a very very kind of immature sangha, that, you know, you often see people who are just ordained and will be, you know, giving, you know, Dhamma talks and things like that the very week that they're ordained often, and sort of going into a teaching and capacity and all of these kinds of things. Whereas we try to, in our tradition, we try to wait, and of course, you know, to giving occasional teachings and helping people and so on is great, is encouraged, but not to be getting too much involved into that thing, that side of things, the public side of things, for a good period of time, 5 years, 10 years, or whatever. So we want people to come here and who ordain here to have that chance to really grow internally and to have the time and the space to do that. And so everybody needs to have patience with that. Both the candidate, you know, the people come here to ordain need to know that. They're not coming to here to ordain because things this week are the way they want them to be. You know, we're thinking in terms of, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years of practice and living, and a development and a maturing in many different ways over that long period of time. That's how we're thinking, that's how I'm thinking in setting the community up here. So as is sort of implied within the Vinaya and the Dhamma, that the first period of time after one's ordination is a time for learning the basics and for getting a grounding on understanding the teachings, learning the Dhamma and the Vinaya, learning the suttas, getting a grounding on your duties, monastic duties and things to do, refining your sila, learning about how to make your robes and bowl and how to look after your requisites the right way, how to do the chores and duties and all of those things. and developing faith through applying yourself to the teachings, learning suttas, learning the Pali. All of these kinds of things, which are quite simple, and they're kind of wholesome and they're nourishing. So these are things which people should put attention to in the first few years of their ordained life. And you're kind of the general kind of overall scheme of monastic career is the first 5 years are spent like that, and then the following 5 years are spent seeking places of seclusion for meditation, and then after that, after the 10th year, then to settle down and maybe take up a teaching role in more in settling in one place. That's a kind of a generalized career. Not everyone follows that. You know, it's not a black and white thing by any means, but it's a kind of a general pattern that seems to work fairly well. So when we come to ordain, you know, it's important that from an external point of view that the community appreciates the need for people to take their time to gradually learn, gradually develop, and also for the candidates, people who come here, to just be patient, little bit by little bit, if we can learn little bit by little bit. And remember that staying in a forest monastery like this, there are so many things that we actually do every day that we don't think about. You know, we actually keep our precepts. We're not drinking, we're not eating afternoon, we're not, you know, we're keeping a celibate lifestyle. All of these things are already quite, you know, we're not killing things. These are already quite an advanced spiritual practice, leaving aside anything else. And it's even quite rare to find in monasteries people actually keeping these precepts as strictly as we do here. And so sometimes we forget those things that we're already doing. We're actually living in the forest, as the Buddha said. And one of the interesting kind of surprising suttas where the Buddha compares a meditator who's sitting in samadhi on the edge of a village, and then with another person who's sitting nodding and falling asleep in the middle of the forest. And he says he praises the one who's sitting in the forest, because the one who's sitting on the edge of the village, soon enough people are going to find out that there's a good meditator there, and they'll come along and be pestering them with questions and so on, and then they won't be able to do any meditation and they'll decline. Whereas the one who's sitting in the forest, if they keep on practicing, eventually they'll throw off their drowsiness and they'll be able to develop because of their seclusion. And so this is something the Buddha praised very, very highly. It's a forest lifestyle. And we have this very, very rare and unusual opportunity to be able to live in such a beautiful place here. So few places that give the same degree of quiet that we have here. So few. And it's almost impossible to find. If you go to, say, to Thailand, you could go to literally hundreds, if not thousands, of monasteries before you'd find a place that's as quiet as here. I'd have to say I don't think I ever went to a place as quiet as here when the whole time I was in Thailand. Maybe the kuti I was in Nan was fairly quiet. So we already have those things. We have the seclusion in the forest. We have the support of a good community, our friends in the Dhamma, who have a similar view of life, similar set of values, a similar way of living, and who want you to succeed. Okay, so everyone around here wants everybody else to do well. We want everyone to have good meditation. We want everyone to succeed in their spiritual practice. And so there's this kind of background goodwill and support which we share here, which we're not always conscious of. We don't always make conscious. But we have that. And again, that's so rare. There are so many people who simply don't have that. Simply don't have anyone around them who vaguely comprehend what a spiritual path is, why one would do it, who are simply completely disinterested and incomprehending as to why one would meditate. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people who live like that, trying to develop their meditation and their spiritual path, and never manage to find a spiritual community like this. So we should be just so grateful for each other, and just so grateful to have this place here to practice in. And so sometimes when we are doing our spiritual life and our spiritual career, we sometimes get restless. We want things to go faster. We want to see more improvement in our meditation. We want to see, you know, things getting better more quickly. And so we try to take up special practices and try to push things along. And yes, sometimes they can be useful, but a lot of times those kinds of things are just a sign of restlessness, a sign of lack of patience and understanding, to realize that actually things are going okay. It just takes time. So sometimes doing special practices is good, but it's usually only good when you have a particular problem, particular defilement, which you want to counteract with a particular practice. So then that can be useful. So for example, if somebody is always nodding when they're sitting in meditation, then they maybe need to do something special to try to make sure that they don't nod while they're meditating. Or if somebody finds that they're at every meal time that they're eating far too much and feeling bloated and so on, and they need to do some special practice to make sure they cut down on their food and don't overeat, or something like that. So we just do those specific things to address specific problems. But otherwise, then it's good just to have that kind of degree of patience. The different kind of ascetic practices and so on in Buddhism are usually very gentle. Even though they're called ascetic practices and an ascetic life, it's a very gentle ascetic life. And things are a bit tough. And in a monastery like this, on a cold night like tonight, yeah, it's a bit tough. It's going to be a bit cold this evening. And, walking through the forest on a night like tonight, these are some of the things we have to deal with, some of the things we have to look at. But this is a very powerful context for practice. It's much more difficult developing a forest monastery than a city monastery. If we wanted to make, like most monasteries in the city, you just make a big concrete building and put a row of dorms there, rooms one next to another, like Buddharansi down near Sydney, or the Thai temple in Canberra. It's taken over from an old Christian convent, and you just have a big building and a row of rooms, and everyone can live in rooms next door to one another. And if you want to build things like that, it's much easier, much cheaper, and much more simple. And a lot of monastics live like that in different countries, including in ancient India. That was the basic design for so many monasteries in ancient India, just a central courtyard and then a row of monastic cells around there. So that's a way of living. But in a forest monastery, we have much more seclusion, much more a feeling of being in the forest. And again, that's something which works its magic over time without us really noticing or doing anything about it necessarily. But just having that appreciation for being in nature. There's something about the smell, the air, hearing the wind in the trees. There's something about knowing the brightness of the outside at night time, whether there's a moon or not, or clouds or not, which you don't see if you've got electric lights around you all the time. And knowing what it's like if it rains and then you get muddy feet the next morning. So all this is part of that lifestyle, which is the samana lifestyle, and contentment, simplicity. So these are the things which the Buddha practiced and the great bhikkhu and bhikkhuni disciples practiced. That's how they lived. That's what they praised. And so we have this great guarantee from the Buddha, this great promise from the Buddha, that this lifestyle is what he designed and refined over his 45 years of teaching. And he designed to be as supportive as possible for the holy life. And so as much as possible, we try to embody these values. And that's a great leap of faith. So one of the qualities which is always mentioned in the time of going forth is the quality of faith. And that's something which is very personal. It's very individual, and it's hard to define or hard to describe. Somehow there's just an intuitive connection with that thing, with that way of life or with that teaching or whatever. And then that gives that trust to make that step. So use the idiom like a leap of faith. So this is what it is, it's a leap of faith. Why? I don't know. Why some people make a leap of faith and others don't? I don't know. Why do we feel that connection? I don't know. I always felt it. You know, for some reason. I never had any doubts about it. So we take that step out of faith and in acknowledgement that in doing so we're following that path which the Buddha practiced and the Buddha praised and encouraged and supported. So of course we can only expect just so much. All the externals can only give us just so much. The place, the teachings, the community. And of course it may well be the case will certainly be the case that different people placed in the same context will respond very differently. For some people that context will be supportive and just the right thing, for other people it won't be. And that's one of the reasons why we encourage people to take their time before ordaining. We don't ordain people straight away. We want you to be sure that this actually is what you want to do. But my experience has been that, as you know, I'm someone who is not afraid to criticize certain aspects of a monastic life if I think those things are necessary. So I'm not a kind of blind apologist for the Sangha by any means. And I think there are some very deep problems in how the Sangha is operating in this day and age. But nevertheless, my experience has been with my friends and people I've ordained with and shared time with over the years is that, generally speaking, I think in almost all cases, over the years, when you see people who've ordained and in robes, that generally speaking, over the years, they just become better. They become more mature, more wise, more peaceful, whatever it is. I don't know what it is. Something about them becomes more together. They become more real or something, I'm not sure. And so I think that's quite a good sign. I think that's quite a healthy thing. And sometimes I hear reports of, you know, people practicing in some meditation centres or whatever where they get great states of samadhi and things like that, but comments made that they seem to be just as untogether afterwards as they were before. Doesn't actually change them very much. And so that kind of thing strikes me that something's not quite right there. So within this lifestyle, One of the things always emphasized within the Ajahn Chah tradition is that your samadhi practice and your meditation practice is only one part. It's a very important part. It's only one part of your overall development. It's not something that can be done and developed in isolation. So the fruit of this life and the fruit of the going forth, as said in the ordination chanting that we were practicing with Gali this afternoon, sabbadukha nisarana nibbana sacchikarana taya, for the escape from all suffering, which and the realization nibbana. So this is why we go forth. So we should never forget that. This is the context, this is the purpose. It should be very clear. That's why we're here. Not for any other reason. Every other reason is secondary. The central reason, the only reason that really counts, is for ending all suffering and realizing nibbana. And so all of these dhammas which we're developing in the samana lifestyle, the dhammas of contentment, simplicity, renunciation, mindfulness, tranquility, wisdom, all of these things that we're trying to develop, these are all qualities of the mind which will fruit and result in the realization of nibbana. That's why we develop them. So this is my little talk for you this evening on going forth, why we do it, what's it all about. So I offer that for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if anyone has any comments or questions.
There's no
kind of formal anagarika phase. There are sort of a few mentions of, for example, people who were staying in the monastery expecting to be ordained, or maybe someone who's a lay supporter, and the Buddha says, oh, you've been a supporter for so many years, how come you haven't ordained yet, and things like that. So this is kind of an idea, like a more an informal idea, but there's probably more of a history to it. But I understand that the status of the Anagarika in modern times was developed by Anagarika Dhammapala, or at least popularized by him. And I'm not sure whether that has any connection with what's done in Thailand. But in our tradition, it's basically come from the practice within the Ajahn Chah tradition. Typically in Thailand, what happens is that when someone seeks ordination, that they'll put on white robes immediately before the ordination. But there's also a kind of an informal thing of white robed lay people who might be wearing like white clothes, but also sometimes white robes as well. Sometimes you have like ascetics who even will live like that without actually ordaining. So for example, Ajahn Yantra lived like that for a few years before it took ordination. So this is kind of informal culture in Thailand, where you have kind of eight precept lay people wearing white, sometimes with robes, and staying in the monastery. Now, when Ajahn Chah developed his ordination system, he sort of used that thing, and that kind of person is usually called a pakhao, and used that platform and extended it as a pre-ordination platform. And typically in the Ajahn Chah monasteries, people would stay as a pakhao for about 3 months, which is like what we call Anagarika. And they are usually, like in Wat Nanachat when I was there, the pakhaos would wear a lower robe, like the monk's robes, and an angso shoulder cloth. Sometimes they would go for pindabhata, for alms round, but since sometimes that was stopped, that was a bit ambiguous. Sometimes you do it, sometimes you wouldn't. But that was very much an Ajahn Chah tradition thing, not found in other traditions. So when the Ajahn Chah tradition monastics came to the West, it generally was found that it was good to keep that practice and even to extend it because of the unfamiliarity of people with monastic lifestyle and monastic culture. In traditional countries, of course, you've got some idea of what a monk is supposed to be and how they're supposed to live and so on. And so you've already got that perception, you've grown up with that from a child. Whereas for us, people come to the monastery, they really don't have any idea what is a monk or what's a nun and these things. So it's really just that acclimatization process.
Yeah. You mentioned the leap of faith. Could you elaborate? Please put yourself in particular situations where you're testing that leap of faith.
Yeah, well, the idea of a leap of faith really is just the idea that you don't really know until you've done it. Yeah? And so perhaps in Buddhism it's more like a kind of a step of faith, you know? There's not this kind of idea of like a kind of throwing yourself mindlessly into it and just trusting to the Lord, but more like, you know, you take a step of faith, say, okay, how's that? That's alright, still solid ground. Okay, I can try the next step. And so you're sort of taking that step and then checking it each way. But you can never know until you've actually done it. This is the thing. But that's the same with anything, isn't it? You know, if you're in a restaurant, you order the whatever it is, lasagna. You don't know what it tastes like until it's actually arrived at your table. But faith is much more about people's, much more of a subjective thing. It's actually a quality of the mind. And so, you know, people tend to have faith. You know, it's a personality character. If you see people who have a lot of doubts, then it's very difficult to overcome that. It takes a long time. Okay, let's finish my thing.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅkha.